Welcome to our Cover to Cover series. So it's kind of a good milestone. So we've been doing this for a while, right? So we've started, as we talked about our education series, we kind of had at one time a couple of classes where we talked about, hey, where did the Bible come from? Big picture, how did it get assembled? We had those classes, and then we thought, well, why don't we, number one, start going through that Bible, book by book, and it gives us a chance to introduce new teachers. Teacher, you know, you don't have to commit to like a 13-week lesson. You can just say, yeah, I'll take this one, so we can get more folks that maybe they can't commit to come in and teach. So we've been at this for a while, going cover to cover, right? So we began on September 1st of last year. So we're now at Malachi, if you know where that is in the book. And you've heard from 15 different speakers, different teachers going through these books of the Old Testament. And so today is Malachi, and Malachi is, in our text, the last prophet that we're going to hear of in the Old Testament, and we'll see kind of what that is. So it's kind of a nice time to kind of think about where we've been, and we'll kind of touch on, as you go forward, more things look back. There are references that, so Genesis doesn't really reference much. It's the first. As you go forward, they kind of bring in thoughts and ideas and themes. You get to really see the themes throughout the Old Testament, right? So I thought we'd start with a quiz. I do sometimes. So
he's
here are five movies. This is, maybe you remember this one, Spartacus. Anyone seen Spartacus? Yeah? Anybody like or dislike Spartacus? But anyway, Kirk Douglas in that, title role. 2001, A Space Odyssey, right? You like those? With Stanley Kubrick, a gem, right? It's a well-known, ahead of its time, like before space travel, they depicted it on film, and it's pretty close to what it would look like because they did the research. A recent one, Asteroid City, a Wes Anderson flick from 2024, right? Maybe another classic, Ben-Hur. Any Ben-Hur fans out there? You've seen that? I think I saw that at school. I think they presented it as a history lesson. I think the teachers just wanted 3 hours. Like, I don't want to talk. So, it's history, kids. Go watch this. I think that's right. And then finally, Sound of Music. Julie Andrews, The Hills of Bavaria. Big fans there, right? So what did these movies have in common? Besides their films, any thoughts? What these things have in common?
Based on a true story.
Historical fiction
based on a true story. What else? Anybody else? They have directors. They're in English. Let's see. Yeah, you can just go down the checklist, right? Yeah. One thing that each of these movies, and there are more that I could throw up here, but these were five across a span. These movies have an intermission.
Oh.
They are all not long, or they may be long. Ben-Hur, I could have thrown Lawrence of Arabia up here, Cleopatra up here. They all have an intermission. Even the 2024 movie, it has Wes Anderson put in an optional intermission as a title card, right? So it's an optional. He's just playing with that. So the intermission came from, in stage days, between the acts, a lot of times they paused, kind of lights go dark or whatever, and they would reset the scene, characters would change costumes, etc. And so these natural breaks in the storytelling process, it translated the movies because, why? Snack bar. Mm-hmm. Not quite yet, but the earliest ones, but save that thought. Change the reel. They had these huge reels. Here's reel one, act one. And we got a pause so that Charlie can grab reel two, put it on. And so they had this intermission. They would show this title card, right? And while they changed the reel, so the directors had to choose, like, where do I break this story up? It matters what the end of reel one, where it stops. I don't want to cut the action in the middle of a chase scene and then reel two starts there. I have to think about the intermission. I had to think where the reel changes. And then in the 50s and 60s, hey, you're making these 3.5 hour long movies. My folks have gone to the concession once. How about we break it up? Because we're pretty efficient. We got multiple projectors. We can make it seamless. Let's break it up because they need to go get more popcorn to help me stay in business. But it really is, it's based upon this idea of where does the story naturally split? So it's a thought process, right? It's not random. Just, oh, it's 200 minutes, cut it like that. And so that's where we are. We're kind of in this intermissional period, right, for Malachi. We're going to, as we think through the Bible, as we think through this story, this big picture story, there's going to be an intermission, and it's a natural breakpoint. But there's one other thing to say here. It doesn't matter. I mean, a side note is like the movie The Godfather did not have an intermission, but they purposely, they were thinking about it, originally planned when Michael Corleone shoots a guy in the restaurant. That was where it was going to be, and then they said, "Ah, we don't need it," so they kept going. So there are it's decisional, right, about what they're going to do. And so here's a snapshot. Ken usually has a timeline. Here's a good enough timeline. It's pretty basic, but you'll see the names of the books you've gone through, the prophets you've heard from, the stories, the books, and it's really telling the story of up till now, God relating to His people. Explaining who He is, what He expects, how He treats the world, how He created the world, how He called His people out. I mean, I was at work one time and I jumped into a conversation on a Zoom call, and a guy was talking about religion already, just the historic side of it. And the guy said, "Yeah, hey, newsflash, the Jews weren't first," was his point, and he was trying to say, I don't know if he's a believer or not from his tone, I doubted it, but in a way, you're right. They weren't first. It took a while for the Jews to be called out. There were other people around. So you could argue over, you know, people started worshiping stones before God came, you know, the Jewish people were established. Well, sure. I don't disagree. That probably happened. So. But the story, fully understanding the story of how God called His people, delivered them from bondage, and showed through, you know, like Exodus, through the leaving Egypt and sinful nature that mirrors our and parallels our own lives, right? We talked about the kingdom, the judges, the period, the kingdom, the divided kingdom post-Solomon, you know, how the northern kingdom, the southern kingdom, both went into captivity, the Assyrian captivity, and we talked about how, like, Samaria and how the northern kingdom set up these idols that reflected exactly what they were told they were punished for, chastised for in Egypt as they left. The golden calf they put to it. They say, these are the gods that brought you out of Egypt, and just so they could have political clout. The southern kingdom, who actually had good kings along the way, who were eventually led to Babylonian captivity. And recently we've been hearing about these prophets in this era that talked about restoration, things to come. And they spoke during captivity. So during this very dark time, there were prophets that spoke, heard messages from God, relayed that to the people, and did things, had, you know, performed signs and wonders, that sort of thing. And so here we are at Malachi, and this is really kind of the last documented prophet. Right, and then we have this intermission, and it's sizable, right? It is not casual. It's not a few years. It's generations of silence, right? We talked. You probably recall as we walked through the first temple, and then the second temple. The second temple is being rebuilt here. So there's lots of, things we talked about, the ways this is presented, it's through poetry, through laws, through prophets and their speaking, is through visions. There are many different ways that God's message comes through here. So I'll pause here for any questions or thoughts or comments of things that you've noticed throughout this kind of journey through the Old Testament. Anything missing? Highlights, milestones that you think, yeah, that should have been on the chart. Okay, very good. Moving along. So just to provide a context, so that was the timeline. So you kind of see where we've traveled through, where we are. And then the context here, again, we're in the post-exile period, right? This is, we've already gone to captivity. We've come back. We've been allowed to come back. I say we as the Jewish folks here, the people of God. We've come back. And at this point, we've completed the second temple. It's there. We've restored the temple, which was, if you remember, you know, when they fought, they were attacked by the people still there in the area. They've got, like, you know, the mortar thing to patch the wall and the spear in the other hand. Like, I got to defend this and I got to make the wall. So they're kind of, it was a tumultuous period where they were not protected, but they built these things and they built the temple because we have to do it and we have to bring back this resurgence in our influence and our power. So that's kind of where we are. I think that's the big things here. So the people, they in some ways they feel like they've done their part. We've created the temple, we built it, it's massive, it's glorious. We have walls, we're kind of back in place, but we're not feeling it. We don't feel it, right? So with that, let's go to, as my thing turns off, as it always does, we're gonna watch the Bible Project.
The book of the prophet Malachi. He lived about 100 years after the Israelites had returned from their Babylonian exile, and his message was directed to the people who had been living in Jerusalem for some time now. The temple had been rebuilt a while ago, and things were not going well. Just remember the stories from Ezra and Nehemiah. Now, when the Israelites first returned from exile, their hopes were high. They would return and rebuild their lives and the temple. All of the great promises of the prophets would come true. The Messiah would come and set up God's kingdom over a unified Israel and over the nations and bring justice and peace for all. But that's not what happened. The Israelites who repopulated the city proved to be just as unfaithful to God as their ancestors, resulting in poverty and injustice. And so in Malachi, we find out just how corrupt this new generation has become. The book's designed as a series of disputes, and most sections begin with God saying something, making a claim or an accusation, and then Israel will disagree or question God's statement. And then God will respond and offer the last word. This happens 6 times. In the first 3 disputes, God exposes Israel's corruption, and in the final 3 disputes, he confronts their corruption. And the overall impression you get from these arguments and disputes is that the exile fundamentally didn't change anything in the people. Israel's hearts are as hard as ever. The first dispute starts when God says that he still loves his covenant people despite their failures. And Israel rudely objects, saying, "How have you shown us any love?" And so God reminds them of how he graciously chose the family of Jacob, their ancestor, to become the carrier of God's covenant promises, instead of Esau, his brother, and the family that came from him, who eventually came to ruin. Remember the stories from Genesis and the book of Obadiah. And so right from this first dispute, Israel is exposed as suspicious, doubting God's love and faithfulness. The second dispute exposes a problem with Israel's second temple. God accuses the people of despising and defiling the temple. And the people fire back, "How have we despised you?" And so God responds by focusing on the people, how they're bringing shamefully lame offerings of these sick, blemished animals that show that they don't value or honor their God. But it's not just the people, it's the priests too who run the temple. They not only tolerate but participate in these corrupt forms of worship. From top to bottom, God's people have proven faithless. In the third dispute, God accuses the Israelite men of treachery against him and their wives, which of course they deny. And God exposes the toxic combination of idolatry and divorce taking place. You have Israelite men marrying non-Israelite women and then adopting the worship of their wives' ancestral gods into their homes. Remember the story from Nehemiah chapter 13. And so Malachi connects this to a wave of men divorcing their wives for no good reason. And the people are all fine with this, and Malachi says, "No, it's a betrayal of your covenant with God." And so Malachi transitions into the second set of disputes that confront Israel's rebellion. So the fourth dispute begins with the Israelites accusing God of neglect, saying, "Where is the God of justice?" They see injustice and corruption abounding, and God seems to do nothing. So God responds by saying that he'll send a messenger who will prepare the people for God's personal return in the day of the Lord. He will come like fire to purify his people and to remove idolatry and sexual immorality and injustice so that only the faithful remnant is left to become his people. In the fifth dispute, God calls the people to turn back to him, to which the people say, "How can we turn back?" And so God confronts their selfishness. He shows how they've stopped offering a tithe of their income to the temple. Now, that word tithe just means one-tenth. It's the amount of their income and produce that the Israelites were to annually donate to support the temple and its priests. The practice is laid out in different parts of the Torah. Now, we know from Malachi and from the book of Nehemiah that the people were neglecting this responsibility, and so the temple was falling into disrepair. And so God confronts them. He says he wants to bless them with abundance, but only if they're going to be faithful. In the final dispute, the people accuse God and say that it's pointless to serve him. They observe wicked, prideful people succeeding in life, and God does nothing. And God's response, for the first time in the book, is not a speech, but rather a short story about the faithful remnant in Israel, people who fear the Lord, and they love to get together and talk about how to honor God and serve him. And so God orders that a scroll of remembrance be written for these people so that they can read the scroll and remember God's character and promises. Malachi, he's reflecting here on the divine gift of the scriptures, how they point us to the past to remember what God has done in order to inspire faithfulness and hope for the future. Which leads to the conclusion of the book. It picks up and develops the imagery of the fourth dispute about the coming day of the Lord, but it develops it further. God says that he's appointed a day of purifying judgment that will consume the wicked from among his people. But what the conclusion adds is the future of the faithful remnant, because for them, the day of the Lord is not a threat, it's a cause for joy. It'll be like the rays of the rising sun that bring healing and life and hope for the future. And so Malachi's disputes come to a close, but there's still a bit more to this book. The final three verses, they're not part of the disputes, and actually they function like a concluding appendix, bringing closure not just to Malachi, but to the whole collection of the Torah and the prophets. So first, the reader is called to remember the law, or the Torah, of my servant Moses. This recalls the story and the laws of the covenant that you find in the first five books of the Bible. But then we hear this summary of the books of the prophets. I will send the prophet Elijah before the day of the Lord, who will restore the hearts of God's people. So this conclusion, it summarizes the Torah and the prophets as a unified story that points to the future. Israel was redeemed by God, and then they betrayed him through their rebellion and hard hearts, breaking the laws of the Torah. But the scriptures anticipate a future day when God's going to send a new prophet, a Moses, a new Elijah, who will restore God's people and heal their hard hearts. Remember all of the promises from Deuteronomy and Jeremiah and Ezekiel. And so this concluding appendix presents the scriptures as a divine gift to read and to ponder and to pray over. They tell the truth about the human condition, about our selfishness and our sin. But they also announce God's promise that one day he would send a messenger and then show up personally to confront evil, to restore his people and bring his healing justice. And it's that future hope that Malachi and the Torah and all of the prophets are about.
All right. Thoughts?
Am I the only one thinking, was this written 2,000 years ago or was this written yesterday?
Yeah, some nice touch points, things to think about, right? Yeah. What else did you, anybody else have anything to know?
Nothing's changed.
Nothing's changed.
That's
yeah.
What I got.
Yeah. Yeah, there's lots of, you know, our sinful condition exists. And it's our hard-headedness, our stiff-neckedness, as the Bible calls it, can really get in the way if we let it. Right? What else?
Seems very much like a
Go ahead.
Like a parent-child thing when you you did this, and they go, what? Oh, I mean, that every time he did that, it just seemed much more like a parent.
I hear my kids' questions.
Yeah.
What defensive.
Yeah.
I never really put the link together of why Moses and Elijah were on the transfiguration. But then the Torah and the prophets is what they covered. And then that's why God says, listen to him and ask him to Jesus, not them anymore. Listen to Jesus now.
Right. A pattern's been given.
Yeah.
But something new is coming.
Right.
Right. Yep. So it is a, again, I highlight the idea that it's an intermission because it's not a rando story. It's like a bookend that tells you, it recaps things, right? It shows you what you should have been listening to. And since it's this far in time, it points back. It points back to Moses. It points back to the law. It points back to Nehemiah. It points back to all this stuff. There's so many references, and that's because we've passed this time. And we have all of these things to reference. Remember what I told you? You remember what I told you? Remember when you did this? And so it has lots of back references. And so, like, growing up, I read comic books. And, you know, the first few comic books are just, it's the story. It's Spider-Man doing whatever. By, like, issue 40, it's like, remember this in issue 8? They recall, they say, you remember this, asterisk? Remember when he had this combo with, you know, Lex Luthor or whatever? That's not Spider-Man. He never had that. I know. But it's these references. So Malachi has plenty of these references going back because these are the things they've heard. And so it is a nice bookend to say, as we lead into the real change, right? The change is coming and we're having this chalk line for this intermission, right? Malachi's, and did you learn anything about Malachi here? Outside of this discourse God has between his people?
Not really.
He just recorded it. I don't know who Malachi is, right? So one thing, and we'll go through this, we'll kind of step through these items, but one thing you'll see if you open up, you know, Malachi 1, you'll see this along with a few other of the books, the messages the prophet spoke, they call it a burden. Transliterate it's a burden. The burden brought to the people. And it's a Hebrew word, massa. And basically, if you see that at the beginning of the book, it's not going to be good for you. You're not going to like it. Like, that's what that means. It's a burden. And so this is like, God's unhappy. He sees something wrong. And so these books, if you notice that, at the beginning of some of these other prophetic writings, buckle up, because you might not like what you hear, and it's going to be instructional, right? So that's kind of what Malachi is presented as, and then like verse 1, let's lead you into that. So we're going to step through the 6 disputes, then we'll talk about this messenger, and then we'll talk about the intermission a little bit, kind of scratch the surface. So the 6 disputes, really these are between God and his people. And so let's talk about the first one. Occurs Malachi 1, and it's just the same things that we just talked through. But let's talk about what happens here. So the first one, and we're going to present it in a modern style so you understand. I loved you, right? God says this to his people. I have loved you. And then they say, how have you loved me? LOL, right? how have you loved us? And then his response to me is very curious. I think you have to fully understand, and you have to know the story, because the one I chose, Jacob, not Esau. Sometimes I think of that as we almost see it as this conniving way that Jacob and his mother kind of conspired against Esau. But in the end, if you read that story, you know, Esau came to ruin. Esau did not value the birthright. He is not the kind of person you would have wanted me to pick. I picked Jacob. I love the one that wanted the birthright, that wanted to be my people, right? What do you think about it? How do you translate this? I think this is a very interesting way to define how he has loved us.
Yeah.
What do you think?
He was making the choice of what's best for his people.
Yeah.
And not what, the rules were of the oldest getting the blessing.
Yeah, and here we are in Malachi, and at the time when you read this story, it's almost like a docudrama, like a, you know, TV show, like, right? But when you look back about where it went, where Esau, the Edomites went, where all these things, how they came to ruin, you see that God had a plan. And it's very much, I elected the, like I chose the better path. You should be thankful. You could have gone this path of destruction with this punk Esau, right? Who didn't want the birthright. Go ahead.
It also reinforces the last week verse idea, and talks about how, yeah, like, it's echoed throughout the Bible, but mm-hmm. it's about how, like, the least of you will be chosen to lead into, I love even the least of you, and the humble will be exalted.
And even the way you think it should go, Esau was first. He was born first, literally minutes, you know, first out of the womb. But I didn't give it to him. I overcame. Like, I sidestepped that. Like, that's not how it worked. So even by the way it should have happened, it didn't happen. And I was involved. Right? Pretty good. Anybody else? Another hand? So we get insights not only into God's character, what he desires, but we also get a look into how he's not bound by certain things. And he's always looking for our betterment. So he's looking for his people's betterment, the Jewish people here. Right? So that whole dispute is to correct them on how they think the world is, right? How do you love this? I'm not a millionaire. I don't have, you know, camels or whatever. Thinking through what they would have said, how did they see it? They don't even see that we're back, that we've got this second temple. They're not even trying to use that. They are seeing nothing. They are not counting their blessings, right? They see no evidence that God has helped, right? That's kind of their defense. So let's move on to number two. Where is the honor due me, and where is the respect due me? For these questions, I also kind of, you know, stop and think about these questions. God, who has everything, made everything, why does he... What does he care about respect? What does he care about honor? Why is he worried about this? Why do you think these are questions from God?
If you don't have respect for God, you're not going to treat your fellow man with respect or kindness either.
Nope.
And that's what was going on in their society.
What else?
It's the basics of love. I mean, yeah, you have to. Love God first before you love anyone else. So you're by not respecting God and honoring God, setting yourself up to be a hateful person.
Yeah, I always go back to probably my favorite verse is the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. If you don't fear the Lord, if you don't honor, if you don't respect, you're on the wrong starting space in your game of life, right? You're not starting at block zero. And so not having that fear of God, the honor and respect, it's not just about I'm jealous of kings or whatever in the world, I'm jealous of them, but it's really more about you're not starting right. You're not starting from the right spot. And everything you do from here is going to be less than. And I want the best for you. So it's kind of, there's so many things loaded in these questions from his perspective about where we start from, what our focus is, where our heart is, but also, why am I getting the short trip? Why am I not getting, why are your hearts not focused on me? You would do it for your mayor, you would do it for your king, right?
I just wonder if sometimes it might be hard for us to understand and appreciate just how important honor was, because it was an honor-shame culture.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have that culture, so honor may not be that important, but for them, that was the most important thing.
Yeah. You know, we could turn this and go, well, what does he get out of it? Well, honor was the currency, right? Not what things do you get, it's what honor do I get.
And if you don't put God first, then you're putting self first. And if you put self first, a lot of bad things are going to come after that.
It's a bad starting spot.
Right, I see these questions also trying to help them open their eyes, forcing them to open their eyes to their self-delusion, kind of like Nathan did with David.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm going to ask you some obvious questions. And you're gonna, you know, no, of course not. And then he leads it to him,
yeah.
Like, oh my God,
it's you.
What have I done? And then, of course, I give you God honor. Of course, I give you respect. And he's gonna show up.
Yeah, not really.
Yeah,
correct. Good. So he calls them. What did he say? The first three expose, the second three confront. So he's exposing right now your true heart, your true intent, where your treasure is, right? And then a very childlike response. How have I defiled you? What? How have I defiled you, right? So, and then he tells them, you've done two things, by saying things and by doing things. The first is you say, my Lord, my table is contemptible. And then number two, let me just show you what you're bringing me. The lame animals, the blind animals, the one you promised this one, but then kind of brought this other one on the side. So these bad sacrifices, they're less than, they're not the first fruits, they're not the best, they're not the things you promised to bring, right? You said these things out loud and you're going to bring these kinds of sacrifices to me and you're not doing that, right?
That's convicting, you know. I mean, how many of us bring our first fruits to the Lord, you know? It's just it's a difficult thing to do. It definitely takes sacrifice. And we just prefer to be smug and comfortable and complacent.
And we also see here, he's kind of saying this things that are also a theme repeated. You say things, and then you do things. So some things you say pretty almost boastful, and then you don't follow through. You do this, and so they don't match. So which is it? And so sometimes we complain, we do whatever, that saying part, and we overpromise, and then we're under-delivering. The doing is the big problem. And so we kind of get more insight in God's nature, what he desires from us, and how he's keeping us accountable as he exposes these things.
And when they kept the good offerings, they were trusting in themselves. This will make my flock bigger. This will, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. Instead of trusting in God who gave them the flock to begin with.
There's a scripture in Isaiah. I've really been studying what true worship is. And this scripture, if you don't mind, I'll read it.
Sure, go ahead. No, Karen, please.
Chapter 1 of Isaiah says, hear the word of the Lord, you rulers of Sodom. Give ear to the teaching of our God, you people of Gomorrah. What to me is the multitude of your sacrifices, says the Lord. I've had enough of burnt offerings of rams and the fat of well-fed beasts. I do not delight in the blood of bulls or of lambs or of goats. When you come to appear before me, who is required of you this trampling of my courts? Bring no more vain offerings. Incense is an abomination to me. New moon and Sabbath and the calling of convocations. I cannot endure iniquity and solemn assembly. And it goes on. And he's saying, I want more.
Yeah, and the things you're doing, the things you're valuing aren't the same.
Things that I value.
Right.
He wants
your,
our heart. He
your
wants
heart,
our true devotion. He wants us to worship him. And sometimes we do things just because it's not real.
Yeah.
I have to work on that too.
Oh, we all do. I mean,
yeah.
I mean these stories, you know, this is not a singular story, right?
Yeah.
This happened over
this
and over.
This is in the
over.
Book of Isaiah,
yeah.
too.
Yeah.
That he wants our true worship. He wants our heart.
These are all great reminders for us.
Mm-hmm.
And self-reflection.
Mm-hmm.
Being humble. That's mm-hmm. Humility is a key word for me. That's it. I think we lack of humility a lot of times. And to say, I've got it figured out, or I don't need to change, is like, that's a bad step. It's a bad statement to make. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. Yeah. Anybody else? Okay. Let's talk about the third dispute. God says, you've turned against me and your wives. And he makes this linkage to how they have divorced their true wives, married these foreign wives, and are now following other gods. And there's this direct linkage that he sees, and he makes it apparent to them. Again, what? How? No. You want me to be happy. And he says, the man who hates and divorces his wife does violence to the one he should protect. The very one you should be protecting, you cast them away, and you're doing violence to that person. What do you think about that statement? Over the top, too much? God's gone a little too far? What do you think?
Well, I think that's interesting that even the he expects dedication to your wife, even if she was the foreign wife, you know, because now you've taken on a challenge that you know, just he's going to help you with, but it's a different kind of challenge than marrying a wife that wasn't a foreign wife. So what it does is it just explains that God really values the institution of marriage.
It also shows how much power the wife has in the marriage. We're going to go worship my gods. Okay. A lot of power there. So he knows the heart of man. He knows our hearts. He knows that we can be led astray. He knows if we're not diligent, if we come into a relationship or we're just trying to keep peace or whatever, we can make dumb decisions. So, but he makes this parallel, right? That by doing these things, and I know where that leads, is the same as what you're doing to me when you follow another God. When you do these things, you're really divorcing me too. Okay? Fourth dispute. They speak up. You've neglected us. Where is the God of justice? And he says, I will send my messenger who will prepare the way before me. So, interesting response here.
I should think they wouldn't want the God of justice. They might be afraid of coming.
If they realize what that means, they may not say it out loud. Yeah, saying these things out loud, thinking these complaints, they're big statements. And they show all these questions and retorts are things that God is pulling from them that he hears, and he's exposing and confronting, like, how little you know about this and how what you're reducing me to. You don't see the things I give you. You don't understand how I haven't neglected you. And you call for justice. And do you understand what that is? Do you give justice too? Right? But he promises. So he doesn't answer or address these directly like, yes, I do. Let me give you the list. He says, okay, I'm going to send you my messenger, though, and it's going to pave the way for this stuff. And you'll see it, right?
Brian.
Yep.
This might also be one of the most that hits home with us today, because they're crying out, because when they say, where is the God of justice, they mean, we see evil people getting a lot, we see good people not getting a lot, where is the God of justice? And we see that today.
No, that doesn't happen today.
Where is God?
That doesn't happen today.
Bad things happen.
Nah. I think it's very fair right now. Everything's going great. It's all great. Yeah, great point. I mean, we see definite parallels. You've probably heard these things, maybe even have said these things. Be careful if you say these things, but yes, if they're how God interacts with us, what we see in the real world, we see very similar things that they did. But he has this promise, and it's good for us to remember how that promise was fulfilled. Very key that we see that came true, right? So let's look at the fifth. He says, turn back to me. How? And he says, start offering the tithe again. So again, the doing, the recognition. There's so much recognition in the tithe and the giving and the offering about who's in control, who you trust, what you're willing to give up, how you present that, how you ready that, what you're willing to sacrifice or give away. It changes your mindset. It shows where your heart is, right? And so, again, there's so many things I think that God could have said here, but that's the one he went with. And I think he was striking at their core problem, right? And so offering the tithe again for this people at this time was critical that they fix that, like, now. Any other thoughts?
Kind of the show me a checkbook and I'll show you what you care about.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there's no checkbooks. That was
it was like a pepper scroll.
Where your heart is, there.
Your treasure, right?
Where your treasure, there your heart is also. So.
Yeah.
That's what he's really saying, is you're treasuring the wrong things.
Yeah, so he's trying to reset their mindset, right? Let's look at number six as we get closer to time. It's pointless to serve God. What do we gain? There's nothing. We don't gain anything from this, from serving him. The wicked succeed and God is silent. And so he, remember, he responds with a short story of sorts. The faithful remnant will be my treasured possession. So he kind of lets them know, I'm here, and those that follow me, it's going to be good for them. Those that don't follow me, it's not going to be so good for them. I am not silent. I am involved. I have been from the beginning. And we've seen that through all the books that we've studied, right? God is there. There are plans. Time may not work. The timing of all this may not work the way we think it should, but he is there. So let's move on to the messenger to come. So this is what it says in Malachi 3 and 4. I will send my messenger who will prepare the way before me. And then suddenly the Lord you are seeking will come to his temple. The messenger of the covenant whom you desire will come. See, I will send the prophet Elijah, a reference to a previous character in books, right? Elijah to you before that great and dreadful day of the Lord, before that great and dreadful day of the Lord comes. He will turn the hearts of the parents to the children and the hearts of the children to their parents, or else I will come and strike the land with total destruction. And so Malachi, we talk about how things are referenced back in Malachi back to the Old Testament. So let's look at the New Testament referencing back to Malachi, to this book in before the intermission. And so John's birth is foretold, Luke 1:13. And I'll just say here, this is all great stuff about John. The key here is, and he will go on before the Lord in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the parents to the children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the righteous, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord, right? So one of those first questions is, you said you're going to send Elijah, and that's going to be, is John Elijah? So keep that in mind. Here it says, in the spirit and power of Elijah. So a first hint that maybe it's not literally Elijah, it's the spirit and power of Elijah. Jesus says, and this is after John asks, like, are you the one? Am I, you know, what are we all doing? And he says, who did you expect to see? I tell you, yes, and more than a prophet. This is the one about who is written, and he pulls this like directly from Malachi, even though there's similar language in Isaiah, but he pulls it from here. I will send my messenger ahead of you who will prepare your way before you. So that phraseology is exactly what is stated in the Hebrew in Malachi. So that phrase is the same. So this is a direct Malachi reference used by Jesus, right? Speaking to John the Baptist, his followers know, they're asking about John, who's been asking questions, and he's talking about him, and he is the messenger. So a direct linkage to the Malachi prophecy being fulfilled. Here at the very end, and if you are willing to accept it, he is the Elijah who was to come. So a direct linkage to that promised Elijah. So that's in Matthew. The next one, at the following transfiguration, we talk about transfiguration, and they asked, why did the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first, which was kind of talked about in Malachi, because they studied Malachi. To be sure, Elijah does come first and restores all things. Why then is it written that the Son of Man must suffer much and be rejected? But I tell you, Elijah has come, and they have done to him everything they wish, just as it is written about him. So again, going back, and then the final one here, John's confession about himself. He did go to the priests, and they asked him, are you the Messiah? I am not the Messiah. He just readily says, I'm not the Messiah. They say, then who are you? Are you Elijah? I am not. So from his own mouth, I am not Elijah. So the thought that he is Elijah reincarnated, he denies it here. Everything kind of points to this. He's in the spirit of Elijah. He is the Elijah, quotes, spoken about, the messenger. He is the messenger, but probably not literally Elijah reincarnated, if you want to think about it that way. So anyway, for you to continue study or look at these things, but these are the references to Malachi, not many, but they all, this idea of a messenger, are, you know, the points in the New Testament that point to that, even by Jesus himself, point directly back to the scriptures in Malachi. So let's talk about, briefly, the intermission. So Malachi's message is given, and then we see about 400 years of silence. There are no prophets sent by God. We see apocryphal writings. Not all were written during this period. So, and then there's waiting on the messenger. So there's just, you know, they're waiting on this sort of thing. So a few things as we talk about, I'm just going to scratch the surface here on a few words. So for the Bible nerds that know more than me, there's apocryphal. That is a adjective, and that applies to not just Christianity, Judaism, it's Hindu too. They have writings, and the word means disputable, mythical, maybe, I don't know who really wrote it. It's become bad, verboten, you know, this is not belong, it's a bad connotation, but it really just means whatever. It's just not whatever. And then there's the Apocrypha. And if you go research that, that's hard to define too, because it's used differently, right? Typically, we're talking about the 14 books that are in the Catholic Bible, but there are many different Bibles, Greek Orthodox, Ethiopian, and they pick and choose, they add, that sort of thing. You're going to see a word if you do studies, pseudepigraph. It's just like, this says it was written by this person. It was not written by this person. A lot of these books that we're going to kind of briefly touch on weren't written in Hebrew. They were in the Septuagint. They were written in Greek. They could have been way old. They could have been in this kind of silent period. But a lot of times they're ascribed to someone, and it's like, no, that person did not write this. And then finally, you'll see this word. Deuto-canonical. Deut just means two. Deuteronomy means the second law, two. So if someone has a second canon, so this is the canon, this is the Old Testament, and then some say, well, there's this other stuff, but we're going to call it canon, but not everybody agrees, then it is a second canon. And so what that looks like, this is really more gee whiz stuff. I guess the first point is the reasons, many of the reasons they were in the wrong language. We can't attribute the author. Sometimes these apocryphal writings were Gnostic writings. They were trying to trick early Christians. They are apocryphal. They are not part of the canon for obvious reasons. Some of these in the Apocrypha, one of the probably the best arguments against them is it says within the document, the prophets were not talking. They were not sent. So pretty good reason that it's not inspired. It just told me it's not inspired. So some of these books have definite reasons why they are, and the Apocrypha for the most part are the way it's described is they're for private reading, instruction. It's good to find to read. It will not be from the pulpit. You will find inconsistencies. There are references to some of these books in Scripture. They knew about them. They make references to like Enoch and that sort of thing, but they are not in the canon. So it's just kind of it's like a very weird gray area, depending on what you're talking about. So if you can see that, hopefully, these are three different canons, and of those books, which ones they include, exclude, placed into their canon. So this is like, hey, this is the stuff that's private. But they took some others and put them in, like they have them, they use them for prayers, whatever. And then this is the King James Version that originally had this. So if you're a King James reader, this was actually included. Of note, two that were in this silent period, or a few, the Maccabees and Baruch, all talk about the history and kind of things, events around that time, this silent period. Some of these are additions to Daniel. So these that have the two double asterisks, those are follow-on added to Daniel that were sometimes included in Daniel, then removed, and extra chapter. They were appended, but they were stories. They were kind of interesting because some of them are like it's like the first idea of a courtroom case and then the first time of a closed room mystery. Like, how did they find out that this, the mystery is this idol is consuming the food, and then how does it happen? And then they discover, Daniel or whoever discovers that, no, the priests are hiding and they're taking the food and saying it's consuming it. It's like this mystery story, right? But a lot of these things are, they're out there, somewhat interesting, but also the big picture is without them, you are not missing anything. The full story, the full mystery of God's been revealed to you through the canon. So if you want to investigate whatever, fine, but just realize there's not hidden knowledge in any of these books that you're missing out on. So the key takeaways, think about these six disputes, what they say about God. He brings justice as well as mercy. He has a plan. He's always been involved, and they don't see it. Do we see it? The promised messenger is John the Baptist, who came in the spirit of Elijah. It doesn't really say he is Elijah, but the spirit of Elijah. And that promise came true. And then finally, time is a character in our story, right? This intermission, the time that these things came to fruition, hundreds of years before the messenger was sent, and those promises are fulfilled. So it's important that we think about not just, you know, the things about the offerings and the tithes and our hearts, but the timeline God is on is way different than our timeline, the way we want things. I think we're 2 minutes over, but if you have any questions, please let me know. But thank you for your attention. I appreciate it. And enjoy the break. Next week is a combined class day, so it just happened to be that it is an actual intermission. So we'll come back with Matthew in 2 weeks. We're still looking for folks to sign up, so we have openings. So those that would like to teach, please reach out. And Matthew is currently open. So if you want to get started for your lesson in 2 weeks, please sign up for Matthew. Thanks.